Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words, with Billy Joel's pressure fading out in the background. This is the episode of September 2nd, 2021. I hope you had wonderful summer holidays. Maybe they're still ongoing. Please enjoy them while they last. And I have a great episode for you today. We will be playing you an interview that has been recorded a while ago about mycotoxin contamination, and I'll be talking to Kanya Rajasekaran, PhD, from the United States Department of Agriculture. Very interesting. Also tells you some stuff about, you know, that you should know about how you keep your food in fridges and so on. And also we talk about agriculture and genetic engineering, which is a topic that is very dear to me, as you know. Also, we will be talking about France, which is angry at airlines for not checking COVID passports correctly. And I'll be chatting to my colleague Fabio Fernandez about a new index that the Consumer Choice Center has launched. So let's get started. So first off, France is not happy with the performance of airlines when it comes to checking those COVID passports. Politico is reporting France wants to strengthen checks on incoming air travelers, Transport Minister Jean-Baptiste Djebbari announced Friday, after a meeting with airlines and airport industry on the proper implementation of the country's health procedures. He calls them bad students, has been saying that some of the airlines have been a bit too lax on how to check these COVID passports. My overall view on this, first of course, we shouldn't have COVID passports to begin with, because I think there's a severe privacy concern and just an overall government power concern that it just goes way over the top. A lot of people wouldn't have agreed with these kind of measures just a year and a half ago. But what I think is interesting there is this is another example of the government outsourcing their policies to service providers. So in some countries, you'll arrive at the airport and then the government, you know, implements these checks for COVID passports. Sometimes these are combined with passport controls, depending on where you're traveling to. In other countries, they do it before you actually fly out. But some countries, which recognize that they don't have the means or don't want to spend the means to actually check these QR codes, they mandate that the airlines ought to do it. And now you are faced with either the airline having to do it or the airline outsourcing themselves that to the airport, means using airport staff. And of course, they're not trained to do this correctly. You know, of course, you'll ask the question, what is there to be trained for? There's just scanning a QR code. But some people will arrive with a paper QR code and it's folded, or they have a test result from a lab that doesn't have the QR code yet. Those do exist. I just recently did a COVID test in Poland, and there they didn't have a QR code available for it. So there's a lot of different exceptions and different rules. And you're asking basically untrained staff to do work, which is basically immigration restrictions, because you can't travel to certain countries if you don't have this test result or vaccine or recovery certificate. So I think France is just getting it a bit too easy by blaming the airlines now to implement a policy, which is very, very difficult to implement. It's really hard to actually do that. I know some countries do, for instance, also random checks where they, like, you arrive and you still have to do a COVID test. And there again, they have to be randomized because there's absolutely no way of checking every single traveler. And of course, some countries don't even check you if you're crossing the land borders. So from Luxembourg, if I travel from the Netherlands to Luxembourg, I'm not even being checked for my COVID status, because the government actually has no means of doing it if you're traveling by land, even though the COVID risk is just as high, especially if you're traveling on a train or a bus. So I just think that governments are getting it a bit too easy here and blaming the airlines for something that really the airlines are not equipped or qualified or should not even be responsible to do these kind of things. In other news then, the Consumer Choice Center launched a new index, and I'm chatting to my colleague Fabio Fernandez about it.
So Fabio, the CCC just released the Fan-Friendly Stadium Index 2021, first of its kind. You've been working with Liz on this index. Give us a bit of an overview. What is the point of this index?
Yeah, sure, Bill. Thanks for having me. So I'm very happy that we released this index in 2021. So this is a project that I've been working on for the past year or so. But last year was impossible for us to release that because we were not allowed to go to stadiums and watch football matches. So now, after COVID, kind of starting getting away with vaccination rollout going in a full speed, especially in Europe, we decided to release this index finally. So the idea here is to give football fans a comprehensive report of what are the benefits, perks, and services that are available on the biggest stadiums in Europe. And basically, we divided what was most important for fans. And we tried to see what was important in terms of watching the matches. So the structure that the stadium provides to the fan, but also the way that the fan could support their team. So being able to see some of the history, go to a museum, buy merchandising from that team. So we tried to look in a very comprehensive way what were the most important things for the fans. So we looked at the 20 biggest stadiums by capacity in terms of size of spectators. And we attributed some points for each of the items that fans and the consumers value the most. So that was size, number of seats, access to public transportation, accessibility, availability of parking, for example, and also if it had some retractable roof that would protect the spectator from watching and from the elements to watch the match. And in terms of experience, we also looked at the stadiums that offer tours, museums, VIP lounge, any kind of membership, and even if they had some kind of kid zone that you could leave your daughter or son while you're watching the match. So we tried to go really deep into this index to look at some of the things that we thought was very important for the consumer and the fans. And one last thing, we also looked at the number of shops, number of restaurants, number of bars. So the availability also of alcoholic beverages, specifically beer, because also this is also very important for spectators on football matches. So yeah, we're very happy to release this index because we think that with all this information, fans around the world, especially in Europe, will have more information about the best places they should go, and especially if they want to support their teams.
And this is a lot of work, a lot of great work. And very interestingly, you know, when these indexes get drawn up that we do, I sometimes think like, oh, there should already be a thing. Like somebody on Google, like if you Google, there should already be a thing. And then very often we find out that there isn't. And so there's a lot of work behind drawing this up, a lot of work in creating this. Can you give us some pinpoints about the challenges that you faced when you tried to get all of this information about the stadiums?
Yes, of course. So the most difficult thing is to find information about the stadiums. We tried to do a global index. We are trying to release the North America one and hopefully a Latin American as well later this year. But the most difficult thing is to find information about the stadiums. And as you mentioned, there are some other stadium indexes or indices out there, and those have different approach to watch they consider to be the best stadium. We are looking which ones are the most consumer and fan friendly. So things that we think these are important for consumers and fans to enjoy and have a good time when they go to different stadiums. And as a result from this index, we had Santiago Bernabeu, which is the Real Madrid stadium, as the top one. Then we had the Allianz Arena in Munich, followed by Camp Nou in Barcelona, Wembley Stadium in London, and San Siro in Milan. So those are the top five, but basically all the top 10 stadiums offer an amazing experience for anyone that wants to visit them. They have shops, they have museums, they offer memberships. So all the good and great things, also Wi-Fi. So you'll probably have a good time going to any of the top 10 stadiums that we ranked.
Well, it'll feel good for a lot of the football fans to get back to the stadiums and be allowed to watch the games live again in person, which is great. Fabio, that's the end of the segment. Thank you so much for working on this. You can find the entire fan-friendly stadium index 2021 under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. And please, of course, follow Fabio's new little social media shenanigans. He does produce videos about some of the topics that we work on at the Consumer Choice Center in very cool video style, a bit of the YouTube feel on whichever platform you're using. So go check that out. So follow us on Twitter and, of course, on Facebook as well to get more of Fabio's videos. Fabio, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
And last but not least, the guest interview of the day, an interview that we recorded at the end of last year with Dr. Kanya Rajasekaran from the United States Department of Agriculture. He's a supervisory research biologist at USDA. And we've been chatting about mycotoxins in this interview. I think a very fascinating, important topic. So take it away. Hello, dear listeners. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Bill Wirtz. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Consumer Choice Center. I am joined by Dr. Kanya Rajasekaran. I'm sorry, I'm butchering your name. But he's a research biologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he's specialized on the issue of mycotoxins. First of all, Doctor, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Bill. I'm extremely pleased to discuss with you about the importance of mycotoxins.
Thank you. So first of all, let's dive into this issue. Mycotoxins, it sounds like a complicated medical term, but so what exactly are we talking about here? What are mycotoxins and what do they mean for consumers?
Mycotoxins is myco refers to fungus. So any toxin produced by the fungus is actually called mycotoxin. And there is almost several millions of fungal species. Out of that, maybe only 70 to 100,000 have been studied very carefully. And of that, there are small section of the fungal species that are actually toxin producing. That's what we are going to talk about today.
Yeah, so there's a wide array of different types of mycotoxins. Can you just lead us through which ones are problematic for human health and do they affect animals? Like what exactly are their effects? What do they constitute?
In fact, only very few fungal species that produce toxins are of importance to us because they are the ones causing a lot of damage to the human health as of today. If I have to name the top three, it'll be the first one will be Aspergillus species, and the second one will be Fusarium species, and the third one is probably Penicillium. And, we work on controlling the Aspergillus fungus, which produces aflatoxins. Aflatoxins is nothing but a subsection of mycotoxins, AFLA, that is Aspergillus flavus toxin. So aflatoxin. So that's how it is got the name. And this is one of the most dangerous, naturally produced dangerous carcinogenic compound. It is so dangerous, the International Agency for Cancer Research, it's a global body, IARC, has labeled this as a group one carcinogen, which is the highest level it can give to any chemical. So this is actually really dangerous. If consumed in large quantities, the acute toxicity results in liver cancer. And in small quantities, it can actually create a lot of other problems like stunting in children, learning disability, that kind of stuff. So we need to be careful not to have this problem permeate through our food supply. But unfortunately, it is not so in several countries where this is not being monitored properly. In all the developed countries, it is being monitored. In fact, the export regulations dictate that they cannot accept more than certain level, depending on the country. So that's being taken care of really well. But in African countries, in Asian countries, this is a big problem. And unfortunately, several people have actually lost their lives because of this toxin.
You say it's a problem that's larger in less developed countries. Can you give us a perspective on how prevalent this problem is in the United States, and then to compare it with other countries? Like how prevalent is this?
Well, let me address this in a different way. What are the crops that are most susceptible for this problem, even including in the United States? Corn, one of the major food crops in the United States, is susceptible. cotton, although it's not a food crop, the cotton seed is processed as an animal feed. So that's another crop. Then peanuts or groundnuts, as they call it in Asia, that's also highly susceptible to this problem. So we are trying to address a lot of means to control this fungus before it reaches the consumer table. So I hope to discuss with you on that also.
Yeah, it's a wide array of products. Now, give us a sense of how do mycotoxins develop in these crops? Like, how does that just naturally occur in all crops, or is there a climate related issue as well?
Well, you hit all the nails right there. You know, in fact, it is a naturally occurring problem. But this problem gets exacerbated because of drought conditions. You know, whenever there is a severe drought or a lack of water and high levels of carbon dioxide, which is another manifestation of the climate change, these all can actually change how bad this problem can be. It can be so bad in U.S. corn industry alone. It expected the projected loss of this problem is up to $1.5 billion a year. So that's what the projection is. But on an average, we do see anywhere from $300 to $900 million of loss. This is crop loss only. So if you include the mitigation efforts, the human costs, the health costs and all that, the costs actually add up quite a bit.
And what examples of health consequences can you give for large consumptions? You mentioned it's carcinogenic. What cancers can it cause, and what other health problems as well?
Well, the Aspergillus fungus itself, when it produces lots of spores, people can inhale these spores, especially in immunocompromised people. This can actually go and dislodge in their lungs, and it causes aspergillosis. That is the name of the disease. But the toxic effect is actually the toxin itself, the toxin, aflatoxin produced by this fungus, when in acute doses, can actually cause liver cancer. And sometimes, like I mentioned, in smaller doses, it can cause stunting in children and learning disability and all that thing. But I'm talking about only the Aspergillus fungus now, but the other major one is actually the fumonisin, which is a mycotoxin produced by the Fusarium fungus, which infects more like corn, wheat, barley, grain, sorghum, all these crops. And this toxin is well known to cause throat cancer, the esophageal cancer. AIR scientists have studied this for a long time, as well as all the university scientists. So these are the two major ones, but of course there are a lot of minor ones called trichothecines and DON, which is dideoxyvalenol, otherwise known as vomitoxin. It actually creates vomiting. So we study only controlling aflatoxin in our group. There are other AIRS groups that are actually studying the toxins produced by the Fusarium fungus, which is fumonisin, and they study trichothecines and other toxins as well.
You mentioned that it's climate specific, but it is still widespread. Does climate change affect the prevalence of mycotoxin contamination?
Yes. Unfortunately, the increasing levels of carbon dioxide and the sudden change in temperature, I'm not talking about 1 or 2 days or a month-to-month variation, but if there is a shift in the maximum temperature, even by 1 degree Celsius, this is what we call global warming, this fungus can actually infect in an area which is beyond its normal habitat. So it can move up to, say, the northern states of the country. And even in Europe, there has been well documented that a slight change in temperature and water availability and carbon dioxide levels can cause a lot of damage with this increasing climate effects.
So let's bring this to a personal consumption level for people to understand. We here in Europe, we've observed this, a recent study by the University of Copenhagen that found that a large amount of consumers think that the fact that product has molds shows that it's natural, and that that even leads to the belief that the consumption of these products after they had mold is safe. Can you speak to this feeling? Do you understand? Like, can you give us a feeling where this comes from? These ideas of consumers, and speak to the dangers of these ideas.
I can actually talk from a personal perspective, and because I'm a plant scientist, so I actually study how to develop resistance to these fungal species in plants. But I'm also I'm directing a group which is working on these fungal toxins also. So we know a lot about the fungus also. So like you said, yes, I agree. There are a lot of naturally occurring fungal species. They are good species. They actually degrade a lot of things that we don't want to see in nature, and they can produce a lot of enzymes that the industries make use of for several industrial purposes. And even cheese, some of the cheese that we consume, they are actually produced because of this fungal infection, some good fungal infection. But we have to caution that even among plants, although all the plants are actually really useful to humankind, there are some plants which are extremely toxic. You know, even if you eat one or two berries of these plants, you can actually die on the spot. You know, like that in fungus also, most of the fungal species are probably good. And I can understand where the reference is coming from. But some fungal species like Aspergillus, Fusarium, when they infect the crops, the fungus themselves may not be toxic. You know, if you say you accidentally ate something that is infected with the fungal mass, that may not be toxic. But when the fungus starts producing the toxins and that toxin gets contaminated the food supply, they become really a big problem. Like I mentioned to you, aflatoxins are extremely toxic. You know, the level is actually the regulation, the international regulation, at least I shouldn't talk about international, the U.S. makes sure that the level does not exceed 4 nanogram per gram. That is, 1 nanogram is actually 1 billionth of a gram. So that is 4 nanogram per gram. In milk and all that, it is still lower, below, not more than 2 nanogram per gram. In other words, it can be a microgram per kilogram, which is one, you know, I'm saying this in nanogram per gram so that you can relate to the toxic effect of these compounds. So the main aspect of this is actually, you know, it's extremely toxic even at a lower level. That's what we need to concentrate on.
Now, you mentioned it's naturally occurring, but the way I understood it, it can also arise as a bigger problem through bad food storage. So what importance does food storage play in this context?
That's a good point. You know, of course, aflatoxins can actually contaminate the field crops. So when we harvest, the grains are already contaminated, because the fungus invaded the seeds and it produces the toxin. This is what we call a pre-harvest contamination. Then once you, even if you harvest clean crop from the field and store it in unsafe conditions, meaning higher humidity, higher temperature, unclean conditions, this fungus can actually start infecting stored grain material also. So the reason why we are working on both, you know, we need to control pre-harvest contamination and we need to control post-harvest storage also. Only then the dietary intake from these grains will be safe to eat. There are many ways of controlling these things. There are a lot of experts in all these areas. Hopefully we can get into that also later.
Yes, absolutely. We will get to that. Now, about the storage, when it comes to retailers, so I spend a lot of time during the summer in Turkey, and I saw very often that in supermarkets, you would have the fruits and vegetables outside, and they would be in the sun at 33 degrees Celsius. Does that constitute a problem? Does this create a similar problem, or is this not an issue?
If you are mentioning about the temperature, maybe that is not the sole criteria for saying that these are vulnerable for aflatoxin contamination. But if we store them in a high temperature, high humidity, this is actually an ideal condition for the fungus to grow, any fungus, including Aspergillus or fumonisin, and they can actually take over the storage lot and then actually produce a lot of toxins. So I won't say only the temperature is a major thing, but there's a combination of things, unsafe, unclean conditions, or storage conditions.
When it comes to marmalade, how does that work? Sometimes I've seen in a marmalade that wasn't closed correctly, you see the mold on top of it. There again, my grandmother would say, just cut it off and then eat the rest. How does that, is it the same there?
Marmalade jar, that's one of my favorite ones also. But unfortunately, if you leave it longer out in the open, this is a way of attracting, even if a single spore lands on a sugary marmalade or any other jam or something, they will start growing. But if you see a lot of them on this spot, you can cut it away. People do that all the time. But the thing is, you don't want to consume when there's an overgrowth of this fungal material on the jars inside or on top of the jam itself or the marmalade. I wouldn't recommend it. It is unsafe to eat anything that is totally infected by unknown fungus at this point. So we want to make sure that people don't eat by mistake. This is a fungal infection. It's a good fungus or a bad fungus. You don't know that. If you know that, that's well and good. But if you do, you have to act accordingly to discard that thing.
Now let's come to the issue of what tools farmers are using to prevent mycotoxin contamination. What products do they use? What methods do they use?
We are trying to deal with this in three different ways. Number one, one is actually controlling the fungus itself, the fungus that occurs in soil, which I'm going to label it as a biological control. When microbiologists or fungal mycologists go and look at the fields, they can sample the Aspergillus species, for example. And there are almost several species that do not produce this toxin. And some they do. So we need to encourage the non-toxin producing strains to grow at the expense of the toxin producing one. That is the whole concept of biological control. That was developed in our institute right here. And now it has been applied to a lot of cotton growing areas in Arizona, corn growing areas in Texas, and peanut growing areas in the southeastern states. And this technology has been exported overseas also. In fact, there are 35 or 36 countries are using this technology as of today. With a lot of financial support from Gates Foundation, the African Union, and Europe has a big a program to control these toxins also. And our scientists are working with people in South America, South American governments, Mexico, Pakistan, Australia, all these places, this technology is being applied to control using the biological control mechanism. So the biological control is one of these better way of dealing with it. But then again, it's not 100% control. Even if you get 80 or 90% control, the toxin level that remains on the crop can still be toxic. So we need to look at other mechanism of control also. So we need to jump to other methods where we can transfer the genes very quickly from a resistant line to a susceptible line. That's where the transgenic mechanism comes in. In fact, this is highly regulated, as you know. We can identify a gene resistant in corn or even other plant species. Then we can move that gene into corn or cotton or peanuts, and we can actually develop resistance this way. And the third mechanism is actually by studying the fungus itself, how this fungus actually gets to make toxin, at what stage. Although we don't understand the whole scope of why the fungus makes the toxin, we can actually identify the fungal genes that are actually triggering the aflatoxin production. And in our unit, we actually deciphered the whole pathway to make aflatoxin by the fungus. So we can actually target those fungal genes and make them ineffective in producing the toxin. How do we do that? We actually enamor the corn plants, empower the corn plants with a gene construct that will actually target the fungal genes. When the fungus invades corn or cotton seed or peanuts, they can actually target this one or two fungal genes only at the RNA level. RNA level meaning it does, you know, so it will degrade that RNA so the fungus cannot make toxin. This is what's called a host-induced gene silencing mechanism. This co-host meaning host plants, they actually silence the fungal genes in either Aspergillus or Fusarium or any other toxin-producing fungi. And they can actually do that without producing any foreign protein in the plant because it's done at the RNA level. So RNA gets degraded, that is actually ephemeral, you know, it disappears. And this goes on, it cycles through and keeps continuously operating in the plant so that the fungus cannot make toxin, or it won't, some of the genes if we target, they will not let even the fungus grow inside the plant. So that's what we are doing. So all these mechanisms are in place. And of course, the most basic practices, you know, how to control it on the field. Farmers have been very knowledgeable to do this. You know, when do you water? When do you control the drought condition? How do you control it? Can you do kind of an application of, you know, any other technology, even using mild dose of fungicides. You know, all these things can be useful in controlling a severe toxic problem, but the longer time-consuming research is actually all those. Biological control is effective, as we know. Producing breeding is time-consuming, but we can actually hasten that by producing transferring genes between places, and we can target the fungal genes themselves by the silencing mechanism, which has been proven very promising in our lab, and we will be testing some of those corn lines very soon out in the field after getting permits from APHIS.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, you can do so by making a donation at consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday. You have to learn.